It was a cold December in old London town. Just 5 days till Christmas and Hanukkah. The fishwives were in bed with their fish husbands, and the lamplighters were plying their trade. Or at least they were, before the greatest storm in a decade swept through the balmy Thames Valley. And so it came to be that Olivia and Aaron found themselves trapped, snowed in. And as the drifts piled higher and higher on the cobbled streets, the two podcasters wondered what on earth to do.
What on earth are we going to do?
I don't know. I'm so cold.
Oh, God.
All we have is this enormous pile of festive food and this busted old TV.
And what of dear sweet Joe Mason? Once a man, then a frog, now a man again. Is he okay?
Don't worry. I checked in with him. He's actually buried deep in some mud for the duration.
As he absolutely should be, and as I wish I were, but alas, I am not a frogman like Joe Mason. I'm a human being, and I am at a lack of words for the peril of this situation.
They're saying we could be snowed in here for weeks.
Oh my God.
I mean, I'm gonna get so bored having to spend all this time with you.
I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, to be honest. And, like, you're pretty high up the list, but you're not my worst enemy.
And it's not like I have any other good entertainment options. I mean, have you seen what's on TV this year? Hey, everybody, it's me, Weird But Evil Guy Fieri, with another episode of Taverns, Alehouses, and Inns. In this episode, I'm gonna stuff a sparrow inside of a smaller sparrow and feed it to the king. Whoa!
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to The Modest Milkmaid. I'm the Modest Milkmaid, and on this episode of The Modest Milkmaid, we're going to have our Christmas Bible study special, in which I will show you how to paint my corpulent milkers to look like Christmas baubles.
And so I said to Ringo, we're not going to do your shit song about an antlion. Go back to the drums. I'm here today to tell you about my new product, the Gun Gun. It's a gun attached to another gun. Call now and receive an extra gun attached to your gun.
But Gay Dracula, we're roommates.
I cannot help it. I find you very attractive.
I mean, that's total shit. Who would want to watch that or even listen to it?
Oh God, we're just completely screwed, aren't we? It makes me wonder, like, back in the day, before they had all of these wonderful modern conveniences, like bad cable TV, what did people even do all winter?
Well, let me tell you.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, who brings the Christmas spirit.
I have so much Christmas spirit tonight. You guys are going to be able to tell about how much Christmas spirit I have. In fact, I'm so underoccupied in the middle of this big snowstorm that, you know, I wouldn't even mind if, say, we lost 45 minutes of recording and had to start the entire episode again from scratch.
That's right. We're just happy to be here. I'm so full of Christmas spirit, if you shake me, I'll fucking jingle. And that's not just because I just had a hearty dinner of coins.
Olivia, you're only supposed to eat the chocolate ones.
Oh, but the foil just tastes so good. It's so full of nutrients, like aluminium.
You gotta get your heavy... Hang on. It's better than just licking a stick of iron.
Yeah. So, let's dive right in to today's topic, which is how to get through a medieval winter.
And not just physically survive it, but also psychologically survive it.
That's right. We're not just talking about how to survive winter, we're talking about how to thrive winter in the Middle Ages.
So the first thing to know about a medieval winter is that if you lived in Western Europe, it was probably a little bit milder even than winters today. So most of the medieval period falls within a meteorological period called the medieval warm period, which is around 900 to 1300, where global temperatures in winter were about 2 degrees warmer than they are now. Now, this is a very, very hotly contested issue. It is based on data from ice cores in Greenland, and so people question how generalizable is any of this to something that isn't Greenland? I don't know. I'm not an earth scientist. But we do have evidence of climactic conditions at certain points in the Middle Ages that are not recognizable today. Like, for example, grapes being grown in the north of England.
But yeah, the main takeaway is that winters in medieval Europe, especially northern Europe, would have probably been around the same temperature as they were today. Maybe a bit warmer, maybe a bit colder. Not absolutely frigid. That came later. In what we know as the Little Ice Age.
Of forgiving who you are and what you stand to gain. Just know that if you hide, it doesn't go away. When you get out of bed, don't end up stranded, horrified with each stone on the stage. My little dark age.
No, my little ice age.
My little ice age.
Yes, there's an,
That's right, they invented capitalism while they were all freezing to death because they had nothing better to do.
God, horrible.
To be fair, if I was living in the Little Ice Age, I probably would also think, okay, we gotta get to central heating somehow. We may as well start.
Yeah, so that's the period from around 1600 to 1800, which experienced drastically colder climates than we have today. So when you hear about Shakespearean frost fairs with people skating on the Thames, that was happening after the Middle Ages. Probably didn't happen much during the Middle Ages. But nevertheless, I wouldn't say that medieval winter is easy.
Not shit.
Most sources we have make it look pretty bad, because it's still pretty cold.
Well, I watched a bit of a brilliant documentary. And I say watched, because it was in Russian with no subtitles, so I mostly just vibed out to a brilliant documentary called Alone in the Past, which is about a Russian guy from a historical reenactor society who tries to live through a Russian winter using only 9th century tools, and I don't know what he's saying, but it's mostly just him hunched over in a lot of dark rooms with a lot of wood smoke in it, and that has shaped my impression of medieval winters.
It's good for the lungs, all that wood smoke.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't stay inside very long.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously different, like, they had different, like, filtration systems to get the smoke out of the room, and it mostly congregates up, which helps, and seeps into the rafters, but it would stink.
Yeah.
Quick sidebar about how much wood smoke stinks. If you've never had to actually live with it, it gets into everything. I remember I went camping a lot in Scotland as a child because we were that kind of family. We were coming back home, and on our way home from our camping trip, we stopped at the library because I lived that flower child lifestyle. And I was walking around in my coat, and I had been sitting by a fire for like 2 nights previously. And as I was walking around, I heard a customer approach a member of staff and saying, "I'm really sorry, but I think there's a fire in the building. I think you'll need to get out." And I was like, "Mom, we need to leave."
That's really funny. Yeah, it stays in your clothes. I mean, when I was in high school, my friends would have like bonfires and campfires at their houses. And when I came home, my mom would smell me and ask if I had been, like, smoking cigarettes or weed. Which, I mean, goes to show you what a square she was, that she couldn't tell the difference between wood smoke and weed smoke. And the funny thing was, a lot of the time we had been smoking weed, but you could only smell the wood smoke on the clothes. It was an overpowering smell. And I really like the smell, actually.
Oh, it's a nice smell, but it's not a good vibe in a building full of books.
Yeah. No, definitely.
So
you'd be pretty chilly, and you would definitely, as someone who is most likely, as most people are, an agricultural worker and beholden to the land and the elements, be working pretty hard to get yourself through the year. And really, preparing for winter is kind of a whole season process. So I actually read a great quote from someone who is a homesteader who says, "We have two seasons on our homestead, winter and preparing for winter."
Well, hang on, you joke. But like a lot of like Anglo-Saxon calendars literally divide the year into two seasons.
Yeah.
Summer and winter.
Yeah. And so to get a better idea of what exactly people were doing throughout the year, I think one of the best sources to start with is medieval calendars, in particular medieval liturgical calendars in prayer books, because it was conventional to have a calendar showing the feast days that took place throughout the year. But in particular, as the Middle Ages went on and very lavish books commissioned for very wealthy patrons became more and more of a hot commodity, you would get these beautifully illustrated calendars, and it became the convention to illustrate each month in the calendar with a typical activity that would be carried out during that month. So these were referred to as the labors of the month, and you would also often have an illustration of the zodiac sign during that month. And so just to give an example of a typical cycle of the 12 labors of the 12 months, although these would vary a bit between time and place, you might see something like January, you would have feasting. Remember, in the Middle Ages, the Christmas period ends on the 2nd of February, so all of January is a period of Christmas merriment.
They did not do dry January.
No.
They did wet. Wet, wild January.
Oh, no, they didn't do dry January. They did not do sober October. They definitely didn't do no, not November.
Despite strong encouragement from the church.
February, your activity is sitting by the fire. March, you have pruning trees or digging. April, you have planting, enjoying the country, or picking flowers. May, you have hawking, boating, and courtly love. June is the hay harvest. July, the wheat harvest. August is wheat threshing. September is the grape harvest. October, you might have plowing, sowing seeds, or making wine. November is often gathering acorns for your swine. And December is pig slaughter or baking of bread. So again, just an example of ones you might see. But those are a very typical example.
And so these labors of the month were not just chosen at random. They were broadly reflective of the kind of work that you needed to do over the winter months. So at the start of winter, you needed to do a couple of things. First of all, you probably need to slaughter any livestock that you want to eat, and you need to process every single part of their body. You know, you need to not just get the meat from a pig, but you also need to collect the blood for making puddings. You need to maybe even collect the bones for reasons that will become apparent later. It's also at the start of winter that you need to start sowing some fields. So wheat, barley, and rye. Get those seeds in before the ground gets totally, totally hard.
Yeah, because those crops can actually be grown over the winter. So there are a few crops that can be sown in the autumn and actually grow through the winter months. And there are a few grains that are among those.
Where this calendar does sort of fall down a bit is this implication that work stops in January and February, because I assure you it does not. Whilst there's not as much you can do agriculturally in the deep, deep parts of winter, there is still work to do. Animals still need to be fed. You need to get that manure out on the fields to keep it fertilized. You're still working. It's still miserable.
A big part of why you would be sowing these autumn crops, although some of them, like greens and broccoli, members of the brassica family, like cabbages and cauliflower as well, would be for human consumption. But a lot of these coarser grains, like rye and barley, although people could eat them, they wouldn't be the preferable thing to eat. A lot of them would be fed to your livestock to keep them going through the winter, so that, for instance, you could still have eggs from your chickens over the winter months. This was absolutely crucial, and it did not mean that work stopped in the winter at all.
No, although the slight reduction in sort of immediate agricultural tasks did mean that, just like your dad, January and February was a great time to do that project you've been thinking about for the rest of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So you might need to spend a bit of time, you know, for instance, repairing that hole in your barn that's causing a draft. Your cows are cold. Every time you go in the barn, the cows are shivering and chattering. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry. I have to go, you know, harvest my grapes. December is the perfect time now to fix this. Improve your cow's quality of life. Reap the rewards of that.
Son, your mother and I are thinking of rethatching the barn.
Yeah, exactly. You go out and your medieval dad is like on his back on a rolling dolly under a cow. Like, hand me the socket wrench. I've got this fixed.
You just hear from the other side of your homestead, son of a bitch!
That's right. One of our puppies just bit me.
Yeah, come on, give me more medieval dad.
More medieval dad. Let me think. Son, come out to the fields and throw this turnip back and forth with me. Daughter, you need to know how to reshoe a horse. If your horse breaks down on the side of the road, you can't be counting on a man to come along and save you. Son, let's throw the old pig skin around. That's right. I just slaughtered a hog, and now we have its bleeding skin. Let's throw it around. Because fuck it, it's the Middle Ages. There's nothing better to do. So yeah, I think...
I love medieval dad. He's entering the canon.
Oh yeah, definitely. And yeah, as well, just basic repairs and things like weaving or fixing all of the holes in your clothing that have accumulated. Maybe you have holes in your pockets that your coins fall out of when you put them in. That doesn't happen to me, but it might happen to other people. Or making baskets, because when you harvest all of your produce in the spring and the summer, you're going to need something to carry it to market with.
Shout out my mom and her basket making.
Yeah, I was in Edinburgh with Aaron's family for Thanksgiving, and we were sitting at home with his dad, and his mom came home with this basket that she'd woven, and like, this is like when I realized your parents have a dream relationship. They're just the loveliest people, because Aaron's dad, who's an architect, saw this basket and was just like, it just like magnetically attracted him. He was like, this is an incredible basket. And he was fawning. It was so sweet. He was like, it's architectural in design. Like the geometry of this. And it, to be fair, it was a really lovely basket.
It was a good basket.
It was amazing. But they're just the sweetest people.
What did we put in it? Did we put breadsticks in it?
They did. Because then the next day, your mom brought it out with like a napkin in it and like bread. And it looked perfect. Oh. Great basket.
So, never say we're not flower children. Where were we?
Baskets.
Activities. Yes. So, point being, it's a good time for projects.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't all cozy stuff, but it was definitely some cozy stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the calendar illustrations, some of them do make it look very cottagecore. So there is one particular medieval manuscript that is generally regarded as one of the most beautiful, luxurious manuscripts of the medieval world. A manuscript that was commissioned by the Duke of Berry, who was one of the most rich and greedy, avaricious people of his day. But he gave us this beautiful manuscript, so you can't blame him. And I just want to describe a few of the months that are illustrated in these gorgeous, full-color, full-page illustrations that we get here. During the winter months, and I'll link the full manuscript digitized in the description. Just go and look at these illustrations. They are amazing, and they are some of the best examples we have of like day-to-day life in the Middle Ages. So in November, we have a gorgeous landscape illustration. The trees in a forest have just begun to turn gold and orange, and a group of men have led their pigs into the woods to root around for fallen acorns. In the foreground, a man in a rusty red tunic and black cap stands poised to swing a club at the branches to knock down more acorns for his swine, who are rooting around eagerly amidst the fallen leaves. A large brown dog waits patiently beside him. In January, we have a grand hall hung with tapestries of battle scenes, where noblemen are attending a New Year's Day feast hosted by the Duke. Clad in brightly colored brocaded robes trimmed with golden fur, they're clustering around a central table piled high with platters of food and gifts. The Duke himself, who's clad in the most intricate, magnificent robes, patterned in blue and gold, holds court over the feast, receiving gifts from guests in their respects, while other guests drink in the background. A white hunting hound in a red and gold collar sits dutifully beside the table as a squire feeds it scraps of meat. And finally, February. In a cottage in a small village, peasants sit around an open fire, and a woman in a blue dress stretches out sock-clad feet to warm them at the flames. A white cat lays before her, and the two people behind her have pulled up their garments to warm their genitals at the fire.
Gotta do it.
Gotta keep those family jewels warm. Outside, snow blankets the earth. Sheep are huddled in a covered pen while the beehives and dovecots stay shuttered for the season. Before a nearby house, a man wrapped in a blanket runs for the door, cringing and blowing on his frozen fingers. While in the background, a man chops down barren trees for firewood.
I love this. I love it because it is so, aside from the genitals, it is such a, these are such universal images. Like, it could be, the scene that you're describing could be something from, like, Little Women or Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales. It just goes to show that, like, cozy vibes are universal.
Yeah, I mean, the guy blowing on his fingers wrapped in the blanket, he's just so relatable. He's very expressive. This is an incredibly expressive manuscript, and he's absolutely hoofing it, trying to get inside. It's a gorgeous drawing. And they really do have their genitals out. I mean, you see the cock and balls, and you also see her vagina, which is not something you get illustrated in medieval manuscripts.
Except when it's Christ's side wound.
That is true. Don't say that to the Twitter tradcasts.
Look, if Modest Milkmaid wants to slide into my DMs, she's more than welcome.
That's fair.
I could fix her.
Now, I need some more wine.
And remember, although these calendars are representative of some things you would do during each month, they're not giving you the complete picture. In fact, they are made to reinforce the views of the people who commissioned them, who are the aristocracy. For instance, do you think that the Duke of Berry liked peasants? And do you think that the answer to that question has anything to do with how they're portrayed in his calendar?
Yeah.
And in general, I think it's a really interesting phenomenon, this medieval liturgical calendar, because remember, these are primarily religious calendars. They show you the feasts of saints that happen during each month, but when you open them up, you're not seeing illustrations of saints. You're seeing these secular illustrations of things people would do throughout the year, and you're seeing the zodiac. And I think there's an interesting thing going on here ideologically, because by presenting these three worlds in parallel with each other, the religious world, the human world, and the world of nature, the changing of the seasons, I think they're presenting all of these things as being kind of facts of life in the same way as each other. So they're showing that the cycle of the year and the yearly cycle of these observations is as much a fact of nature as the changing of the seasons and the need to feed yourself and work the land. So everything has a place in the world. Everything was created and given this cyclical sort of life for a reason. And in the same vein, by presenting the secular and the natural world in tandem with the spiritual world, it's also giving a bit of spiritual weight to your day-to-day activities, even ones that aren't directly observational or religious. And I think as well there is something going on with the human activities that are shown, and that some of them are things carried out by the aristocracy, like hunting and hawking and courtly love, things like that. And some of them are things that are being done by peasants, so a lot of the agricultural activities. And these aren't things that would be done by the same people, so the people who are going out riding with their hawks and courting ladies in walled gardens are different, presumably, to the people who are plowing the land and sowing seeds of wheat. But by showing these people's activities in tandem with each other, the implication is very much that the activities of the aristocracy are as much natural and as much part of a natural lifestyle as working for sustenance and working to sustain yourself.
I would also like to draw out something a bit more explicitly here, which is the seasonality of chivalric romance. So, Olivia, what are the months for courtly love and chivalric romance and things like that?
Well, you've just unlocked a buried traumatic memory, which is that my high school musical teacher was obsessed with medieval music and made us sing medieval songs.
Yes.
And I remember singing, in the merry month of Maying, when the merry lads are playing, fa-la-la-la-la. So May, that's May. But okay. Just wanted to recount that I was forced to sing medieval love ballads as an awkward teenager.
Nice. Thank you. Everybody's learning a lot about us this week. So one of the interesting things about the chivalric romance as a genre is that the protagonists are very, very rarely subjected to bad weather. This is something that there is an exception to this, and you're already thinking about it. Don't fucking write in. I know. I'm about to make the point you're about to make. Sometimes you have to put these disclaimers out there, because I don't know if you noticed. This is now another tangent, but it's absolutely staying in. So Spotify, when it's presenting episodes of the podcast, you can look at it gives you like a little snippet of the podcast to listen to. And for our episode about space, it's like, it cuts off at the exact second where we're like, well, everybody knew in the Middle Ages that the Earth was flat.
Oh no!
So, yeah.
Spotify had betrayed us.
Spotify, a bad company.
Yes.
So Arthurian stories, for example, take place in a sort of permanent, balmy springtime. And the weather and climate very rarely impacts the romantic heroes and gets in their way. Unlike in the modern novel, where actually the weather is a pretty major factor. Think about all your favorite books. Sometimes it rains. Now, this might be because medieval art generally doesn't depict the nobility interacting with winter. Think about all the winter scenes that we pictured here. Yes, you know, we have the lord out on his hunt, but he's not having a shit time. He's having fun. Everybody else who has to warm up their pussy.
Yeah, exactly. There's lords hunting in the autumn, but you don't see them in the snow.
No, because winter is something that happens to poor people.
Yeah, it's funny. It's was true then, and it's true now, unfortunately.
And now I'm going to bring up the obvious counterexample to the point that I was just making, which is Gawain and the Green Knight. Now, Gawain and the Green Knight takes place over two Christmases, right? Winter, in the initial sort of scene setting where the Green Knight shows up and is like, eh, lads, you know what would be a laugh? Chop my head off. There's no sense that winter is intruding on their Christmas. They're having just a merry Christmas, and they're like, ha ha, huzzah! Another story!
Woo!
Huzzah!
Chop his head off!
However, when Gawain has to go on his spiritual journey to find the Green Knight the next year, we actually get, for the one of the only times in the entire genre, we get descriptions of suffering through the elements. So, if I may. So many marvels, by a mountain there the man finds. It would be torturous to tell of the tale. Sometimes with dragons he wars, and wolves also. Sometimes with wild woodsmen, haunting the crags. With bulls and bears both, and boar the other times. And giants that chased after him on the high fells, had he not been doughty, enduring, and duty served. Doubtless he had been dropped and left for dead, for war worried him not so much. But winter was worse, when the cold clear water from the clouds shed, and it froze ere it fall might to the fallow earth. Near slain by the sleet he slept in his steel, more nights than enough on the naked rocks, where clattering from the crest the cold burn runs, and hung high over his head in hard icicles. Thus in peril and in pain, and plights full hard, covers the country this night, till Christmas Eve, alone. Gawain's journey is a spiritual trial to sort of achieve chivalry, right? And so winter is a form of spiritual test that's part and parcel with the other human and supernatural forces that Gawain has to face on his journey. Since I'm talking about sort of winter as a motif in medieval literature, let's also talk about Dante. So in Dante's Inferno, the ninth circle of hell, the final circle of hell is the place where the heads of traitors are trapped in ice. And we get a wonderful freaky description of that.
When we were down within the darksome well, beneath the giant's feet but lower far, and I was scanning still the lofty wall, I heard it said to me, "Look how thou steppest. Take heed thou do not trample with thy feet the heads of the tired, miserable brothers." Whereat I turned me around and saw before me and underfoot a lake that from the frost the semblance had of glass, not of water. So thick a veil ne'er made upon its current, in winter time Danube in Austria, nor there beneath the frigid sky the dawn. Livid as far down as where the shame appears, were the disconsolable shades within the ice, setting their teeth unto the note of storks. Each one his countenance held downward bent, from mouth the cold, from eyes the doleful heart, among them witness itself procures. When round about me somewhat I had looked, I downward turned me and saw two so close, the hair upon their heads together mingled.
Ooh.
It's very spooky, it's great. It's very Christmas Carol, actually, that.
Sorry.
So I think there's something to be drawn out here, which is that winter as a motif in medieval literature is associated with spiritual testing and spiritual punishment.
I actually watched a YouTube video in preparation for this that ended up not being that informative because it was about 2 minutes long, but it was a guy who put on armor and went out in the snow to see how it would be. And his conclusion was basically, this sucks. He was like, the armor is cold and it's making me cold, so I'm going to go inside and take it off. And his conclusion was putting on medieval armor in the winter was not good.
Yeah. So I think that what we can surmise from this literature survey that I've done is that, yeah, winter is bad. And winter is something that people are subjected to as a form of test or punishment. And so the nobility, who are quite literally your betters, why would they have to suffer it?
Yeah.
It's a way of making the material inequality of winter into a form of punishment and reward, you might say. And saying, you are enduring this because you must be tested. Not because, you know, if the Lord actually just shared some of his firewood, none of this would happen.
So winter absolutely would have been a time of hardship for medieval people. And I think the question of survival and how to keep yourself fed and warm would have always been on your mind. So we already mentioned agriculture, that you would have still been plowing and sowing and tilling throughout the winter months. And you would have had to prepare extensively during the summer and the autumn to make sure that you had food. So any food that you harvested, any crops that you didn't give to your landlord for taxes or sell at the market, you'd probably want to preserve so it doesn't just go off. And so there were lots and lots of different ways to do that. And we actually have some written records, recipes of how medieval people preserved their food. So for instance, pickles, you could pickle your food. We have some recipes for these. They often include a lot of spices because if you don't have spices, the recipes would just be like vinegar and pickles. And so here's one from Germany. This is a 14th century recipe and it says, flavor caraway seeds and anise with pepper and with vinegar and honey. Make it gold with saffron and add thereto mustard seeds. In this condiment, you may make pickled parsley and small preserved fruit and vegetables, or beets, whichever you want.
That's very generous.
I know. And then there's fermentation, of course. So in particular, beer and wine. They're not just delicious and do not just help you relax after a long day of tilling the fields, putting up with your annoying medieval wife and kids. Because remember, there's no medieval football on the medieval television.
If you want a medieval football, you need to do it yourself, goddammit.
Yeah, exactly. They're also great ways to preserve all of those calories from the grapes and the grains that you harvested. Of course, you can also ferment milk. Medieval cows, bear this in mind, don't make milk year-round, only just after they've had a calf. And so when you milk them, you want to be able to preserve that. And of course, there are also vegetables and fruits you can ferment. So for instance, sauerkraut. Yum, yum.
All right, little German girl.
I mean, I hate to say it, but because of my German upbringing, I do love a bit of sauerkraut.
There's two things that I love about being German. Sauerkraut and being rude to strangers.
Lederhosen und Berghain. Of course, meat you can cure in salts. Pigs, slaughtering pigs was in particular seen in the medieval calendar in the autumn because you wouldn't need those pigs. You know, your cows can make milk. Your chickens can make eggs. Pigs are basically just there for meat.
They're as fat as they're going to get.
Exactly. So yeah, you slaughter them, slice them up, salt them, smoke them, whatever.
Salted pork.
And you'll be eating lots of bacon over the winter, which, to be honest, not that bad.
Hell yes.
I mean, sparingly.
That's like, good news for for our new character of Medieval Dad.
Yeah. Oh my god, yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Oh, Jonathan, bacon again, isn't it?
That's right, Mildred.
Of course, you can preserve fruits and vegetables in salt or honey if you can afford salt or honey. And this is controversial, but I will say a lot of foods you can just leave out. A lot of cheese and grain and stuff. Grain in particular, you can basically just let it sit out. It will be fine.
No, it won't. Rats will eat it.
That's what your cat is for, obviously. Ye old medieval cat. And a lot of different fruits as well and vegetables can basically just be left out. So I actually read a really interesting study of someone. This wasn't like an academic, by the way. I say study. This was someone with their blog trying to figure out how to best preserve apples. And they actually found out that apples stored in the fridge last for like a couple weeks, but apples stored in at room temperature in layers of straw last for several months.
First of all, who's putting apples in a fridge?
I mean, yeah, to be fair. But they also tested...
That is sicko behavior.
They also tested fruit bowl. They had fruit bowl and, like, basket.
Well, I know the fruit bowl's not doing anything.
And so that's why you gotta get the straw. The straw absorbs moisture, and it absorbs the ethylene gas that apples produce and that fruit produce.
Tell the baby bell story.
Causes them to go...
Tell the baby bell. Tell them the baby. So the first time we tried to record this episode, Olivia had a whole rant about how actually you don't need to preserve food. Well, don't keep it cool. It's actually fine.
I'm not like one of those raw milk freaks, but I think sometimes this is one of those things. You cannot talk about these things without people saying that you're disgusting. But, like, I genuinely think people overcorrect a little bit too much about things like food safety and hygiene. You know, people who are like, oh, you don't wash your chicken before
cooking it. That's nonsense.
You make me sick. But once when I was in Glasgow, I ate a Baby Bell cheese that had been in my suitcase for more than a week. And it was fine. I was fine. And my point in telling this story was to explain that a lot of our modern food hygiene standards with regards to how long things need to be refrigerated for, and I promise I'm not sponsored by Big Botulism, are slightly arbitrary.
Now listen, I just want to get out ahead of this. There's been a lot of stuff in the news about podcasts which promote dubious health claims in the UK recently, and I just want to know, and I just want to say, if we end up in, well, let's be honest, not BBC News, probably your local council's paper for promoting... Actually, it's fine if you eat cheese. It's been out for 4 weeks.
It's bad to pasteurize your milk because pasteurizing it takes out all of the little men that get into your brain when you drink it and tell you to commit acts of violence to local politicians.
All right, Robert F. Kennedy.
I think that with a lot of careful planning and hard work, you could definitely, even as a peasant, survive the medieval winter. I think your diet would not be very varied.
Nah.
I think it would be quite bad. Sort of on a flavor level, you would be eating like a lot of things that are basically slop.
I have some recipes for slop.
Woo!
So.
Let's get sloppy.
Yeah. So, I have two recipes. So, your staple food of an evening when you're sitting around with your awful kids... and you're bored out of your mind because you can't read. Oh, God, imagine winter without books. Oh, I'd just shoot myself with a crossbow, honestly. You gotta be eating potage. Now, this is just essentially, you take whatever veggies you've got, you put it in a pot with maybe some stock, if you're lucky, and then you eat it. Maybe you thicken it with breadcrumbs or barley, but like, that's what's for dinner. Now, the staple veggies would be things like cabbage, turnips, leeks, and onions, so the potage itself would be quite thin. And we have some recipes for it from the Form of Curry, which is a recipe book by Richard II's Master Chef. And I'm going to read you some recipes from this, and I want you to tell me whether or not you'd eat it. This is the first one. This is just for a generic potage. Take kabocches and quarter ham and sieve them in good broth with onions in minced and the white of leeks a slit and core small and do therefore saffron and salt to force it with powder douce. Now, to translate, essentially, you chop up some cabbages in a pot with some minced onions, leek, saffron, and salt, and something called sweet powder, which is a mix of cinnamon, cloves, and sugar that would have been very much a staple. It was sort of the Italian seasoning.
I'm not gonna lie, like, the sugar, you had me with the cabbage, onions, leeks, saffron, and salt. The sugar,
I don't know.
I'd have to taste. You put sugar in everything savory and spices in everything sweet. And I guess I respect that hustle. And to be honest, like, it was probably better than nothing. So, maybe.
I've got a second one, which is for blanche pur, which is golden leeks. To make blanche pur, tack with leeks and parboil hem and hue sem small with onions. Cast in good broth and seethe it up with small birds. Color it with saffron. Powder it with powder douce. So once again, you take some leeks, parboil them, you know, chuck some onions in, and then small birds.
Nice!
Is whatever you can find.
That sounds good.
I've never been a fan of boiled meat.
Yeah. Well, I think like simmered in like simmered in stock is different to just straight up boiled, which is quite depressing. No, I'm sorry. I don't respect. I couldn't eat that. That doesn't sound very good. But yeah, it would be a lot of bowls of different things mixed together.
Bowls of very thin stew.
Yeah.
But it would be warm. So, how do medieval people stay warm? I'm going to keep this very quick. It's the same. It's mostly the same as what we do. Get some fires going, wear a lot of layers, and keep moving. But there is one extra thing that I don't think people do know about, which is medieval hand warmers. Do you know about this?
No.
Oh my god. So basically what they would do is you get a metal ball or tube and then stick some charcoal in it. And then that would heat up, and you could... Well, no, because you have to keep your hands warm. Because, like, churches now, right, are freezing.
Mm.
Still. But if you're in a medieval church where they ain't got, like, the little heaters that they sort of wheel out, you know, it's going to be bad. And it's a very serious issue of what if the priest's hands go numb when he's trying to do some sort of important sacrament. So they would have these incredibly ornate little balls that would hold a charcoal, and you could just hang onto them, and they keep you warm.
Sounds amazing.
It's very charming, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that I read about the turnspit dogs, the dogs that get put in cages that are hooked up to spits to turn the spits, is people would bring their turnspit dogs to church to use as foot warmers. You just bring your little dog, and you put your feet under the dog. And there was also an anecdote about how these dogs would be trained to, like, start work when they heard a bell ring. And then when the church bells rang, the dogs would all get up and run out the door and be like, oh, shit, I'm late for work. I'm late for my dog job. Isn't that amazing?
That's brilliant.
But, yeah, I think the February illustration in the hours of the Duke of Berry goes to show you something else about keeping warm, which is that, having discussed how valuable cloth was in the Middle Ages in previous episodes, a lot of people would just take the blanket off their bed and wrap that around themselves and wear that around if that was all they had.
Listen, I've thought about it.
It was anything you could do to stay warm. And I think it would also help that in the Middle Ages, most families would sleep in one big bed together, so you would be pretty cozy in there, to be honest.
They'd be Charlie bucketing it.
They would be Charlie bucketing it so hard. Well, no, Charlie has his own bed.
Yeah, that's true.
They'd be Grandpa Joeing it.
Grandpa Joeing it. What a fraud, by the way.
I know. So, looking at the bigger picture, you would probably be able to survive. Probably. All right. Not everyone made it, of course. I read a paper about nutrition specifically in the early Middle Ages. I think you can apply some of it to later periods as well. Basically looking at, like, how well nourished would you actually be eating the food that was available to you in the Middle Ages. And the author's conclusion was that it was theoretically possible to get enough of a varied diet to be just fine. That doesn't mean that it happened in practice, especially if you lack a modern knowledge of nutrition and the nutrients like iodine and vitamin C, from which deficiency...
You mean vitamin cabbage.
Yeah, well, yeah, of which deficiencies can very rapidly cause you serious health problems or death. One sec, I have to whine Aaron. He's holding out his mug.
We've recorded 2.5 episodes of the podcast.
Oops,
tonight.
That was a lot, sorry.
No, it's fine.
ASMR. I like that anytime, this is a pro podcast recording tip. You got to be listening deep into the episode to get this. If you're recording a podcast and you make a noise that you didn't intend to, like you bump something, just say ASMR and move on. It's all ASMR. Anyways.
I feel like my brain is dying.
Your brain is so healthy. It's fucking pulsating with life.
No, it's actually reaching the point where I feel like I'm approaching some kind of, like, spiritual awakening.
Oh, I was thinking more like ego death.
Same thing, some might say.
But medieval people didn't have modern knowledge of nutrition, and they probably didn't know that scurvy was a thing. Scurvy in particular is tricky because throughout history, people keep discovering and then forgetting and then having to rediscover what scurvy is and the foods that prevent it. So yeah, cabbage and like brassicas, so broccolis and cauliflowers in general would be one. But if you don't have fresh fruits and vegetables, then you better be fermenting that cabbage because... fermentation is one of the only forms of preservation that does keep vitamin C, that doesn't destroy it. So
wow,
you might be feeling a bit rough at the end of the winter if you haven't had any
just
vitamin
rolling
C.
Rolling out of bed feeling like absolute shit.
Your like teeth are falling out. Oh, yeah. Your hair is falling out. Potatoes have vitamin C, so people in the New World, I think, would have been just fine broadly.
There's a smash cut to like some, I don't know, like some Native American like community in like Florida just being like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. I love December.
No, it's great. I mean, like potatoes and tomatoes are both extremely rich in vitamin C. They were swimming in vitamin C over there. In the Middle Ages, it was like, have you had your cabbage yet so your teeth don't fall out in 12 days? So,
meanwhile, yeah. Meanwhile, I got, like, some band in, like, modern-day Minnesota are doing, like, feats of strength.
Yeah. Exactly. They're like...
up entire ice sheets.
They're like, it's late January and I feel more vigorous than ever.
Who wants to go for an ice bath, lads? Huzzah!
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, they've done a lot of studies on skeletons they've exhumed, and quite a few of them have suffered with but not died from various forms of malnourishment. And a lot of people's teeth actually were broadly okay. If you look at, like, archaeological studies of people's teeth, they generally, until, like, the modern age, just get worse and worse over time. So medieval people had worse teeth than people in, like, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, but much better teeth than people in the early modern period who were just absolutely binging sugar and it was just completely wrecking their shit.
Yeah, no, they had all the access with none of the sort of regret and guilt that we have.
Exactly. Like a child on Halloween.
Further evidence, by the way, that the classic thesis that everything that everybody thinks they know about the Middle Ages is actually about the early modern period.
Yes.
Guess what? You think you know about something about the Middle Ages? You're thinking of the 17th century, idiot.
Yeah.
So, another thing we wanted to do in this episode is talk about not just what do you do to survive, but what do you do to have some fun? Because guess what? Life isn't just drudgery. Sometimes you've got an afternoon to kill. And it turns out that a lot of the stuff that we like to do in winter now
is also the same stuff that they like to do in winter then. And I'm thinking about, well, first of all, snowmen.
Yeah, so I was actually, I need to explain, I was going to research a bunch of different winter activities, but I got so caught up in snowmen, and I found so much more information than I expected to, and I'm so excited to share literally all of it with you guys. So massive shout out, first of all, to self-described snowman expert Bob Eckstein, who wrote a 2007 book on the history of the snowman. It's called The History of the Snowman. It's on Internet Archive. You can log in with an account and read it. This guy knows his snowmen. He goes all the way back.
To what?
Well, it's great because he starts early in time, and then one of the last chapters is called The First Snowman.
Wow.
I just wanted to mention some of the chapter titles in this book because I think they explain very well how much this guy cares about snowmen. I wrote these down on paper, not in our notes document.
She's literally reading from her book right now, her notebook.
The Hollywood Years. There's no business like snow business. The Revolution of 1870. The Snowman's French Role. Early American Snowmen in the 17th Century. New World. Fresh Snow. Belgian Expressionism, The Miracle of 1511. Have you heard about The Miracle of 1511?
I have not.
Oh boy, well you're gonna love The Miracle of 1511 because it has everything to do with snowmen.
Okay, hit me.
So I should mention, of course, some people, you said 1511, that's not medieval. Well, we
don't
have
care.
Examples of similar events to this happening before then. This is just the biggest and the best one.
And also, shut up, I don't care.
Man, big and good.
I've recorded 2.5 episodes of a podcast that I don't care.
Big and good, it absolutely is. So basically, around the turn of the century, Brussels was a respectably sized Belgian town of around 30,000 people.
Well, it wasn't a Belgian town.
Yeah, Flemish town. Blah, blah, blah. I don't respect any Belgians or their national identity.
Hell so yeah, yeah, high five.
Woo!
High five!
Yeah!
Get that, Belgians.
And basically, to cut a long story short, there was a very long cold winter, and surprise, surprise, there were also pre-existing tensions in this area around things like class and politics, which meant that some of the people in Brussels were not completely happy with how things were being run.
Class politics in a 16th century urban center? Who would have thought?
Yep. So in particular, people were annoyed that the local Duke, Charles V, had left his palace and gone to live with his aunt, Margaret of Austria, who was kind of a powerhouse. Very powerful and ambitious lady, but people didn't really think it was cool that he just up and left.
Is Charles V of Emperor?
I don't know.
Hang on a minute.
Maybe.
Very important context here that we have just checked and then edited out. Charles V was 11.
What? They were beefing with him? Okay, that recontextualizes things a bit. Whatever. They were pissed. They were beefing with this fucking fifth grader. I also have a note on Margaret of Austria. She was a very politically powerful and ambitious woman. And Agrippa, the physician, famous physician, wrote a book that he dedicated to her. The book was titled Declaration on the Nobility and Preeminence of the Female Sex. So he wrote a book called Why Women Good and dedicated it to her. That's so cool.
I'm going to be real with you. That is exactly something I would do.
Need her. Anyways, let's get to the miracle. The miracle, the miracle. So
the miracle on 45th. Street of Brussels.
Yes. So in some sources I read, in order to distract people from the fact that their lives were pretty bad, a festival was thrown. In other sources I read, the following events just sort of took place spontaneously. But either way, the citizens of Brussels took to the streets after weeks of rising tensions and a sudden, unprecedentedly large snowfall. And they began to make masses of snowmen. And
take that, ...
Take that, child. And so there are records of these snow festivals and mass snowman making happening before this, but this is by all accounts the biggest and most dramatic one. So at least 110 snowmen were made, and that might not sound like a lot, but these were incredibly detailed. A lot of them caricatured the politicians and nobles with whom the common people were frustrated.
And that's so good.
So, for instance, there was a snow sculpture of a naked virgin with a unicorn in her lap. Now, that's pretty bog standard Christian imagery. But it was made in front of the palace of the Duke. And so the implication was that the Duke was like a little unicorn who had run away to the safety of, you know, this lady. And he only felt comfortable and safe when he was in the lap of a lady.
11 years old.
Yeah, I know. There were snow caricatures of, like, people from the neighboring village who then proceeded to get, like, smashed to pieces. Oh, and this is my favorite part. Philip of Burgundy, who was the admiral of the Dutch Navy, reportedly built a snow sculpture of Hercules with incredible, astonishing beauty and accuracy. So modern analyses explain this by the fact that he was at the time employing a court painter who he had just employed, and a court artist who he had just commissioned to paint several pictures of Hercules, and who was also a trained sculptor.
Hercules? More like Hunkules.
But Philip definitely took all of the credit for what was probably mostly this guy's work. But I really like that.
Check out those pecs that I made.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, it wasn't just the common people. Everybody was out there making snowmen. And apparently...
That'll show them.
Yeah. No, things got heated, okay? Things got heated because they were beating up the snowmen, and they made it illegal to beat up the snowmen. There was one snowman of a specific farmer, and his head got knocked off 3 times. People hated this guy.
Why did they keep knocking off me snowhead? They don't understand.
And then there were examples of people putting, like, rocks in the snowmen so that if you tried to punch them, you would get hurt. It's absolutely, and this is the miracle.
What was the miracle?
The snowman.
Oh, the miracle was, and then the one of the greatest miracles in all of the history of Brussels. The people, they made a lot of snowmen.
I haven't even explained the best parts, though.
Uh-huh.
So apparently around half of the snowmen were vulgar or sexual in some way.
Of course.
There was apparently a snow nun lifting up her dress to show off
her snitties.
Her snussy. Yeah. And
this is a serious, legitimate show.
There was a snow boy pissing into the mouth of a snow drunkard.
Wait a minute. A pissing boy? In Bruxelles?
Yeah, so that was a famous kind of artistic motif before, even before the permanent fountain was there, was the little pissing boy.
Never felt more powerful than when I was in Brussels and somebody asked me how to find the mannequin piece.
Oh my god.
And I was just like, it's over there.
So there were like pooping snow cows. There were all sorts of different motifs and themes. There was apparently a corpulent snow prostitute who was sitting naked. And I should mention that our source for most of these descriptions comes from one specific poet. So the fact that this took place has been corroborated, but a lot of these very vivid descriptions come from one poet, Jan Smeken, who was the court poet of Brussels and recorded them in absolutely beautiful detail. I looked for a English translation of this poem. I could only find like a Middle Dutch version. Not even of like a modern Dutch version I could Google Translate, which was quite sad. So, I'm sorry, I don't have too many extracts, but
I've got an extract here. Yeah, man, I don't know what to tell you. They kept making all these weird snowmen. What were they trying to achieve? I don't know.
Some say a miracle. First of all, okay, a few quotes from Bob Eckstein about this event. He says, "This was their Woodstock."
Oh, I need to buy this guy a beer.
Yeah, you really, really
do. If he's still with us.
Oh, he very much is, yeah. This chapter opens by saying, by the way, it took him over 35 months, but Michelangelo finally finished his 17-foot-high statue named David. Yes, it would become the world's most famous statue, a monument to civic courage and male beauty. But 7 years later, something immensely more momentous occurred in the world of sculpture. A bunch of Belgians made a town full of snowmen.
This is so cool.
Anyways, on to the quote. In the Rosendahl, a wonder was to be seen. A huge, plump woman, completely naked. Her buttocks were like a barrel. Her breasts were finely formed. Ah. A dog was ensconced between her legs. Her pudendum was covered by a rose. The coffer beneath the rose, once you taste it, causes many a man to part with his silver.
Can I say something without everybody getting mad?
Sneedsner?
I feel like this is such a cooked energy, but this is such a cooked thing that, like, stumble across.
It's really good. It's really... The book and the fact that this happened are both... I mean, the book... This book is incredible. This guy talks about how he would go to, like, rare book dealers and historians and ask them if they knew anything about snowmen and say that he's a snowman historian. They would just, like, hang up the phone on him and tell him to get lost, but he that's persevered.
Like, that's, like, something that would happen to Joe Parra.
I know. I have one more thing about the miracle of 1511 and a few more things about medieval snowmen.
How long have you got?
So they also depicted one of the snowmen they depicted was a symbolic battle between winter and summer.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you know who...
Getting abstract.
In, you know how you have kind of personifications of different natural forces, like Father Time.
Yeah.
Do you know who the medieval
Old
Dutch...
Old North Wind.
The Old North Wind. Do you know who the medieval Dutch personification of winter was?
Not Sinterklaas, surely.
No. Okay, I'm gonna tell you.
Okay.
It was the king of Friesland. Because in Dutch, Fries also means freeze. So he was the king of Friesland, but also the king of Frisia, which is a region of the Netherlands.
Oh.
Isn't that good?
Oh, that is muy.
So yeah, it's good gear. So, anyways, a lot of these probably were rather crude sculptures. Some of them apparently were quite lovely. And apparently in the 15th century, there are quite a few records of Florentine noblemen. Of course, this is more Renaissance territory, but of Florentine noblemen, on the rare occasions when Florence did get snow, commissioning artists to make them snow sculptures. So we have...
That is so classic Florence.
This is going
I'm going to pay a man to build a beautiful snowman, and it's going to be... I've become Borat!
No, literally, so listen to this. In 1494, Piero de' Medici...
Oh, of course it's the fucking Medicis.
And this guy's like one of the worst Medicis, commissioned Michelangelo to make him a snow statue.
Oh, wait, hang on, which Piero is it?
This guy was called Piero the Unfortunate.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He drowned in a river.
Yeah, that Piero.
Yeah, he was known for being a dick, and so this was obviously a bit of a dick move.
No, because... he was a huge loser.
Yeah, but he made Michelangelo sculpt him a snow sculpture, and records from the time, we don't know exactly what it looks like. The only records we have are that it was banging. People are saying it looked absolutely beautiful. That's all we know about it. I think to give some context as well, at the time... Michelangelo was 19 and Piero was 22. So these are like two adolescent boys beefing with each other.
My neighbor Michelangelo, he cannot build snowman. Great success.
So yeah, there are other examples. There's an example from 1407 of a snow statue of Hercules in the same plaza where Michelangelo built his. And of course, it is very typical Florentine excess to commission things that are made to basically vanish.
Paying a guy to make a snowman is like, it's such a, it like if you were writing like a incredibly on the nose satirical novel about the excesses of Florentine capitalism, that would be it.
Yeah, no, I actually read an entire article about consumable and disposable Florentine artwork.
Yeah.
One of the things they mentioned was that Leonardo da Vinci was once commissioned to make marzipan sculptures and then basically had to stand by and watch as this horde of noblemen, like, gobbled them down. And he wrote in his diary, like, this made me quite sad.
This is the thing that everybody thinks of Florence now is like this incredibly refined historic city. What you have to understand about Florence of like the 15th century is that it's essentially like Dubai now.
Yes, Dubai with more booze.
They are the most grotesque nouveau riche freaks currently on the market. Like, if the World Cup I'm sorry, if the fucking World Cup existed in the 15th century, the Florentines would have paid FIFA to host it.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
That's what they did with, like, with, like, that papal conference.
And so this beautiful chapter ends with the following text. Meanwhile, the following year, Michelangelo pulled off a little thing called the Sistine Chapel. Blasphemous! How dare we lump Michelangelo in with the pedestrian activity of snowman making? Ah, but Michelangelo had already made a snowman earlier in his life, so clearly everybody is out there making snowmen. And so we have another chapter about politically incorrect snowmen. There were a lot of sexual snowmen that were made. There is actually a mention about Joan of Arc snowmen, who they did make.
And, yes, it was a way of commemorating her the year after she died.
Yeah.
People got very into it. It was quite nice.
And then we actually find one of the things that this guy does. He tries to trace back, because these are what we're seeing. They're not typical snowmen, right? They don't look like a snowman as we think of it, with these spheres of snow stacked on top of each other. And one of the things that this guy, Bob Eckstein, tries to draw out is working out whether or not people made snowmen that looked like this. And so this takes us to one of the final chapters, which is called The First Snowman. It opens with this beautiful illustration
of a snowman in the stocks.
Of a snowman in the stocks.
With his little twig arms poking out.
And one of the things that he does is he finds what he describes as the earliest visual evidence of a snowman from 1380. So that very firmly places the snowman in medieval territory. Yes. And I think with the wealth of 15th century snowman sources, it would be foolish either way to claim that snowmen didn't exist at the time. And according to him, the first ever depiction of a snowman that we have on record is actually an anti-Semitic caricature. It's a snow Jew melting in front of a fire.
No! Oh no!
So yeah, here it is.
Oh no! He's so cute though!
I know!
But he's got the nose!
He's got the nose and the hat.
They gave the snowman a yarmulke!
And as you can see, he's made out of spheres. And so this is one of
the... There's three stereotypes that everybody knows about Jews. Number one, they wear yarmulkes. Number two, they have large noses. And number three, they are made out of spheres.
But as
three
you can,
spheres stacked.
As you can see, this is a proof that they did make snowmen out of stacked up spheres in the Middle Ages.
It looks like Watto.
So this concludes my section on medieval snowmen.
I think I'm dying.
Don't show this to your bubba.
So, another thing that is classic snow-based activity. Shut up! A classic snow-based activity. Snowball fights. These calendar illustrations attest to this. It's mostly children doing it, but we also have at least one image of a man and a woman exchanging snowballs in a very flirty way. They're both sort of posed like, ooh, oh no, don't hit me with your snowball. We also have lots of evidence of ice skating. Ice skating, medieval people definitely were into that. Now, ice skates are actually much older than the Middle Ages. They were invented 3,000 years ago in... Guess.
Turkey! Turkey number one!
Turkey number one invention of ice skating. Finland. Now, Finland, what does Finland have in abundance? Number one, ferocious winters. And number two, too many lakes. Now, that means a lot of ice that you need to traverse day to day if you want to travel in the winter. So ice skating, it's a practical solution. Now, very important context. What is an early ice skate? It is essentially a bit of bone that you strap to your shoe. Guess what? Set up and pay off!
Woo!
Yes, this is real podcasting. So, bone skates move at about 8 kilometers an hour, as opposed to up to 60 kilometers an hour on modern steel skates. And they also have no sharp edges, so you can't move with them in the usual sort of swishing motion. You know, that's me demonstrating swishing. Yeah. So you need to use poles to push yourself along. Now, edges were invented by the Dutch in the 13th century. Now, over time, ice skate materials did evolve. By 1200, they're using like steel, bits of iron and ash wood to make your ice skates. But actually, bone skates did continue to be used because making bone skates is incredibly easy. All you really need is a long bone and some rope. There's no like special skills
needed. Fun activity for the kids.
Yeah, no, literally, like the articles that I read were like, yeah, a child could do this.
Well, yeah, and 8 kilometers an hour is not bad. It's still much faster than walking.
Yeah.
Walking, now, that's like maybe 5-6 kilometers an hour at most.
But if you wanted really high quality skates, you could go to a specialist ice skate workshop. We have at least one of them attested to in Norway.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So you like there's a guy who just makes ice skates.
Oh yeah, my name is Olaf. My name is Hans Olaf Jorgensen, and I make the ice skates.
Now, ice skates are old, but ice skating for recreation may actually be a medieval invention. Because one of our oldest attestations of ice skating for fun comes from medieval England, from one of Thomas Becket's clerks. And he describes what London's like in winter.
When the great marsh that washes the north wall of the city is frozen over, swarms of young men issue forth to play games on the ice. Some, gaining speed in their run, with feet set well apart, slide sideways over a vast expanse of ice. Others make seats out of a large lump of ice, whilst one sits thereon, others, with linked hands, run before and drag him along behind them. So swift is their sliding motion that sometimes their feet slip and they all fall on their faces. Others, more skilled at winter sports, put their feet in the shin bones of animals, binding them firmly round their ankles and holding poles shod with iron on their hands, which they strike from time to time against the ice. They are propelled swift as a bird in flight or a bolt shot from an engine of war. Sometimes, by mutual consent, two of them run against each other in this way from a great distance, and lifting their poles, each tilts against the other. Either one or both fall, not without some bodily injury, for, as they fall, they are carried along a great way beyond each other by impetus of their run, and wherever the ice comes into contact with their heads, it scrapes off the skin utterly. Often, a leg or arm is broken, if the victim falls with it under him, but theirs is an age greedy of glory. Youth yearns for victory, and exercises itself in mock combats in order to carry itself more bravely in real battles.
I really love that because, I don't know.
Again, very Dylan Thomas.
And like, I don't know, you don't know this because you didn't grow up somewhere where like winter sports were like the predominant activity. But like, just
You have no idea what Massachusetts is actually like.
Just getting like fucked up on the ice is just like, it's such a relatable childhood activity. Put me and all my siblings in the hospital.
I was big on the ice skating. I went to classes and shit, although my mom did make me wear a bike helmet.
Oh, same. But yeah. That was only after my brother split his face open and had to go to the hospital.
Oh, man. So yeah, those are the kinds of fun activities that you can undertake in medieval winter. Mostly they involve using snow in interesting ways and falling over.
Sorry, I remembered that when I was a child and I was just learning how to ice skate, my parents would get like a big paint bucket that was empty and like turn it upside down and I would put my hands on it and skate.
Oh.
Because I was one bucket tall, approximately. One bucket up to my chest.
It's so cute.
I know.
So, everything has to end. Both podcasts and also seasons. And the last great winter festival of the medieval calendar was Candlemas on the 2nd of February, which fell halfway between the equinoxes. Now, it's marked by both the Eastern and Western Christian traditions. And the feast marks the presentation of the infant Jesus to the temple in Jerusalem. The texts presented for the feast emphasize the paradoxes inherent in the
unimaginable strength of the eternal god displayed in the fragility of a newborn child, and the appearance of divine light in the darkness of human sin, and basically more generally of renewal and rebirth in this kind of dark time of the new year. Basically, and this is a motif that we've explored in a previous Christmas episode, the idea that fundamentally medieval Christians thought about the coming of Jesus as synonymous with the return of the light, which is one of the reasons why I am quite skeptical of the argument that, like, oh, well, you know, 25th of December was just chosen for Jesus' birthday because it's like pagan holidays happen to exist at that time. The entire medieval concept of God was so wrapped up in the cycles of nature, as we've kind of explored up to this point. And so the coming of spring had an almost kind of spiritual dimension to it. That yes, we are bringing forth new life, but we're also bringing forth new spiritual life. I mean, for God's sake, the Lamb of God, can you make it any more explicit?
Yeah.
So I'm going to end this episode with a reading from Maxims 1, which is a poem in the Exeter Book, which talks about the end of winter and the coming of spring. Frost must freeze, fire burn up wood, the earth grow, ice build bridges, water wear a helmet, wondrously locking up shoots in the earth. One alone shall unbind frost's fetters, God Almighty. Winter must pass, good weather come again, summer, bright and hot. Sorry, my beloved co-host is looking incredibly cozy and comfortable.
I'm actually wearing this, like, cozy jumper with Celtic knots on it. I'm just laying on the floor nodding at Aaron, like, yeah, man, that's good.
Good vibes. Going to do us for another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast, and also we are going to be going on holiday.
Woo!
For our respective spiritual feasts.
Yes!
That we do, that happily have happened to coincide for some reason this year.
Oh yes.
Olivia will be back at home with her family celebrating Jewish Christmas, and I will be back at home with my family celebrating Christian Hanukkah.
Oh, that's good. Very good, very, very good.
And by the way, we hope that you have a peaceful and wonderful holiday season, however you celebrate it and whoever you celebrate it with. Just, you know, take care, because winter's cold, but the new light is coming once again. We're halfway out of the dark.
The seasons are changing. The winter wheat will soon begin to sprout.
Spring is just around the corner. And if you like this podcast, please leave it a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And also, you can leave us a Spotify comment. And if you do, one of us might read it out on the show. And there's nothing people love more than having their things read out on podcasts. I should know. I listen to podcasts.
And if you didn't like our podcast, write to the government. Ask them to make it illegal to podcast. They probably won't.
Please.
But they might.
Please, Keir Starmer. My people yearn for freedom.
Thank you to someone whose username is just the letter T, who commented on Pets in the Middle Ages. Love the Martin Luther cameo. Was wondering when Christendom's greatest keyboard warrior and most prolific blue-checked 1524 professional hater was going to make an appearance.
He would pay for Twitter. He would absolutely pay for Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, God.
8 quid would be, like, nothing to him.
Oh, Jesus. 8 quid, and he would just constantly post, like, don't jack off. go to mass. Read your Bible.
Oh, God.
He would definitely be like a Jordan Peterson.
Yes,
like,
Jordan Peterson is exactly who I was thinking of.
Cut the porn. Don't listen to whores.
But do hang out with dogs.
Do hang out with dogs, yeah.
And never, ever stop posting.
Only the greats have the stamina to just constantly generate content.
Not us. We need to take a month off.
All right, I am hitting stop.
All right.
We love you. I love you. If you're listening to this, I love you in a romantic way.
Yeah, sorry. I feel deep sexual love for you.
You appeared in my dreams last night. Thank you.
All right. Take it easy. Woo.